Hello and welcome to the OneMSL podcast, a forum that seeks to champion field medical excellence through sharing a diverse range of voices from across the pharmaceutical industry and beyond. Tune in with each new podcast to stay up to date with current trends in medical affairs and enjoy fresh insights from our guests. My name is Helen Kane. I am CEO of OneMSL, a specialist provider of training and consultancy to the global medical affairs community. Welcome to our One Community webinar, Real World Evidence 101. Fantastic to have you all joining us today. By way of introduction, I'm Helen Kane, CEO of OneMSL. This is the first of our 2024 webinar series, our industry webinar series, which we are very proud to host for industry participants. And today I'm super excited to be joined by Sam Oliver, who I will allow Sam to introduce herself, and Georgie Nock, both from Spark Evidence. So Sam and Georgie, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Helen. Thank you for inviting us to join you. So nice to meet everybody. So I'm Sam Oliver, one of the founders of Spark Evidence. I've got over 25 years in the pharma industry in clinical development roles and working with CROs. And then in the last 15 years, I've been working in real world evidence, both local and global projects, generating great real world evidence in a multitude of ways. So nice to meet you all.
Hi, everybody. I'm Georgie Nock. Also, almost 25 years in a background in the pharma industry. Started out working in clinical trials, and then about 13 years ago, moved over to working more in real world evidence. So, yes, I've spent my time running and designing real world evidence projects with pharmaceutical company clients, leading global real world evidence teams, and then founded Spark Evidence with Sam last year. So, yeah, very excited to talk to you today about real world evidence.
So we've done introductions, so thank you everyone for bearing with us. So, you know, let's start with why. So when we think about these webinars, and I was discussing with Sam and Georgie the idea of doing a collaboration, you know, really, because this is what we speak to, really, we are here to support companies to really be optimal in the impact and the contribution of medical affairs. And you'll all be familiar with this slide and this idea that medical affairs today is recognized as the strategic partner, as the third pillar of pharma. And what the evolution has meant has been really this recognition that the breadth of activities and the competencies required by individuals working in medical affairs are evolving. And on this slide, you will see here that we are sharing the MAPS, the recently published MAPS competency framework, where they clearly call out evidence generation. And within that, we see real world evidence. So, no great surprise there. But what we do also know is that medical affairs are engaging earlier and earlier in the life cycle. In fact, data from our survey in 2023 revealed that 19% of MSLs were engaging as early as phase one. So through this very early life cycle engagement, there is an opportunity for medical affairs and, of course, for field medical to contribute to the achievement of company and strategic medical goals. And very often, the way in which we can contribute is through the support of real-world evidence and evidence generation activities. So that is really setting the scene for today. And when I sat down with Sam and Georgie, and we were thinking about the framework for the webinar. And I felt that, you know, let's call this Real World Evidence 101. Let's think about the big questions that we can address in the confines of a webinar. And through the responses, then hopefully we will be supporting all of you to understand more about real world evidence, what it might mean for you within your role, within your organization, within your therapeutic area. So we have these 9 questions that we're going to explore over the course of the webinar. So without any further ado, let's get straight into it. And I think, Sam, I'm going to start with you. Is that correct?
This is, yep.
So the big question, what do we mean by real world evidence?
Thank you, Helen. So kind of starting with a very basic definition, there are lots of different definitions, but they all have a commonality. So real world evidence in its broadest form is any healthcare data that's generated outside the constraints of a clinical trial. There's a lot of talk, you'll hear people talk very interchangeably about real world data and real world evidence. Officially, real world data is the data that's extracted, and the evidence is what's generated from the data. So that's the kind of definitions in general. Everybody has a slightly different definition depending on their scope. So if you look at the FDA in the US, of course, they're looking at real-world evidence in order to make regulatory decisions about products. So their definition is quite clinical. The Institute, the International Society of Pharmacoepidemiological and Outcome Research, ISPOR, quite a mouthful, they're very much a focus more from a kind of an HEOR perspective. And I've just popped in from NICE here. They recently, last summer, published real-world evidence guidelines. Many of the other reimbursement agencies have done the same. And they're obviously using a very similar definition, but applied to reimbursement. So we'll talk more during the webinar about what exactly, what type of data it is and where that data comes from. But just in terms of the definition, that's what we're aiming for.
So I'm guessing if you know, for people on the webinar who want to go and learn more as a result of what it is that we're talking about today, I know from past experience that the FDA, actually, the website is quite nicely designed. You know, the way in which things are explained is quite straightforward. So I suppose a good starting point, if you wanted to learn more, would be to think about the guidance that might most closely relate to what it is that you're, the real world evidence that's current for your organization. Is that right? Because NICE is clearly very UK centric.
Yes, exactly. And actually, ISPOR is very, very helpful because they're global, that they have chapters in Europe, in the US, in Asia. So actually, they give quite a nice context of what real world evidence is and some guidelines about the best way to generate that and things to consider.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Good starting point. So we've sort of started to scratch the surface in this, Georgie. So when we think about real world evidence, and I know that this is something that the three of us explored, you know, can you just walk us through what is the process for the generation of real world evidence?
Yeah, sure. So the starting point is really to identify what data you need. So we call it doing a gap analysis. So what data is missing? And you need to think about all the different stakeholders. So who needs what data? Is it HCPs? Is it patients? Is it payers? As a company, do you need data further down the line to support your product lifecycle? And what we'd really recommend at this point is that you use a very multidisciplinary approach. So you pull together, and it will be a slightly different team within each company. Everybody has different groups, from medical, from HEOR, from market access, maybe from ClinOps. Get everybody together and really discuss what type of data they need, when they need it, and then you're probably likely to find that there's some commonality, and you'll be able to run and design projects that meet everybody's needs. Something else that we always recommend at this point as well is that you have some key opinion leaders or HCPs to ratify the data gaps that you've come up with, to make sure that once you've gone to all the trouble of collecting it and analysing it and publishing it, it's actually going to answer people's questions, because it's quite timely and quite expensive to do a lot of these projects. So you really want to make sure that the answers you put out there are answering people's questions. Obviously, once you've decided what you need, you then need to put together a design or a plan. Usually, most robust research is going to require some form of protocol, which you may be familiar with from if you know much about clinical trials. And it looks very similar. It's a plan that is going to contain your project objectives, endpoints, the methodology you're going to use, any approval requirements, your analysis plan, your publication plan, and the beauty of putting that all into one document. And it may be simple, it may be complex, depending on the how complex your project is going to be. But the beauty of putting it all together is that it then means that it's going to be good quality and that everybody using it is going to be doing the same thing and working in a very uniform way, which is part of the point of having a protocol. The other reason it's good to have, or you will have to have a protocol, is because it will have to be sent to any regulatory bodies like ethics committees or regulatory bodies to get approval for your study to go ahead in the first place. Once you've done all of that, then you go about actually gathering or extracting the data. So depending on your study design, we'll talk more about what they might be later. That could involve analysing existing data sets. And they may be small, they may be just one hospital only data sets, or they could be large global data sets. But if you're not analysing existing data, you may be designing a bespoke project where you're actually going out and collecting what you need. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Or you could be implementing surveys or questionnaires for patients, for healthcare professionals, for carers. You could be doing structured interviews. There's all sorts of different ways to gather this data. Once it's all in, or during the process of it coming in, there's usually some form of quality control run to make sure that data is good quality. So making sure that it's accurate, it's verifiable. If there are any queries on the data, you're going back to the people who provided it to you and you're making sure that you understand it all so that you can then analyze it in line with the analysis plan that you put together, which again, may be very simple. It may be very complex depending on where the data is going, what you intend to use it for. And then the last part is really that this is the so what. This is why you started this whole process in the first place. What are you going to do with this data? So use it to make a difference. So that might be that you want to publish it, you want to present it, you want to use it for medical education. But it's really important that that loop is closed. So the reason that you started collecting the data in the first place, you're actually coming to fruition and you're using that data to make a difference.
So that's really really straightforward, I think, in terms of the process and the steps. And I guess on reflection, when we were sort of having a conversation about this a little bit earlier, I was thinking about timelines, but I guess just listening to you now, the need, I'm assuming, will fall out of your strategic medical plan. So this should really be sitting alongside your strategic medical planning process. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would, I guess the word of advice is these studies are not always very quick. We're talking months to years, not weeks, most of them. Some surveys can be a little bit quicker. So yeah, plan ahead, know when you want the data, know when you want to present it, and then work your way backwards from there.
Fantastic. Okay, great. So Sam, so thinking then about, we've got the various steps. So what is it that needs to be considered? Because this, you said that this was a cross-functional team effort, but really drilling down to, in terms of medical affairs, what needs to happen at each of the stages?
Okay, so I guess we would say that medical affairs are a critical linchpin for these type of projects at each one of the steps that Georgie's just talked through. Right back at the start, when you're identifying your need, of course, medical affairs are a key part of that cross-functional team. And quite often we find that it's the medical affairs team who are the first to identify the data need, because, of course, they're perhaps the closest to the customers. As Helen said, it's very important that when you've identified a need, that fits with your medical strategy. In terms of the designing and planning, medical affairs are critical to understanding whether is this project even feasible. So does it make scientific sense? Do these patients exist? Where are they sitting? And the selection of kind of key opinion leaders and healthcare professionals that you may want to ratify your plan. Of course, it's quite often medical affairs who have the closest relationships there with the type of people that you want to engage. In terms of the process for gathering or extracting this data, again, medical affairs have a great role to play. They can be the link with healthcare professionals for any questions about data collection if you're doing a primary data study. quite generally it would be the go-to point for any questions about the patient population, about eligibility, and where you're doing secondary data studies, a lot of the complexity is around understanding the coding and understanding how medical conditions are coded in existing data sets. And again, medical affairs are really key to helping to kind of boil down exactly what you need. Quite often in those type of studies, you need kind of algorithms to identify this particular type of patient by using a number of different proxy markers, and medical affairs are critical in producing those. We've also worked a number of times on surveys that are deployed by MSLs, and so again, that's another area where medical affairs can get involved. In terms of the analysing the data, that medical can provide that insight to support data interpretation. So does the data make sense? Does it reflect current thinking? Quite often real world data can be quite dirty, there can be missing data. So allowing that kind of interpretation needs the kind of medical expertise input. And then the dissemination and communication. So medical are key to inputting into what the key messages are, which conferences or journals would you like to disseminate the information through? How are you going to work with your authors? So identifying who the authors will be and how you'll work with them. So across the spectrum, medical, very, very important to generating real world evidence.
So I suppose just reflecting on what we've covered so far. So identifying that a process exists is probably number one. And for individuals who are part of Big Pharma, I've no doubt that these processes will exist. But many people who are listening to this webinar here, who are either with us today or who are listening on catch up in the future, maybe part of startup biotechs where these processes don't exist. And I guess that a challenge could be, in the absence of your process, that timelines are missed, that outcomes are not well defined, people don't have clarity on expectations. So, and as you said, you know, these can be very expensive exercises, so it's so important to get it right. So if we then move on to the next question, because this is something that I really didn't have a sense of the scale of this. So you said that it's different to evidence that is gathered during clinical studies. So this sort of slightly blew my mind, I have to say, when we looked at this slide to begin with. So are you going to walk us through this, Georgie?
I am, yes. So if we remember what Sam said at the beginning, that real-world evidence is any healthcare data collected or recorded outside of a clinical trial. There is a wealth of data out there growing every day that you're able to use as part of a real-world evidence generation project. There are many, many different methodologies. We can talk a little bit more about some of those later. And there are many different types of data that you might want or might need. So one of the most common ones that we regularly collect is clinical data. So with all the right permissions in place and patient consent and ethical approval, you can dive into actual medical records. You can get clinical outcomes, patients. You can look at safety events. You can look at disease pathology. You can look at medications, what happened next, all sorts of data, which is really, really rich data source. And you can get almost exactly what you needed. If it happened in the real world, you'll be able to collect it. The other types of data that you might want to look at, if you want any sort of, if you're forming an economic argument, you might want to collect data that possibly already exists, or you may need to go out and actually get it through a prospective study. But looking at the burden of the disease, the cost of treatment, the societal burden on patients and carers of the particular disease that they have. And there's all sorts of ways to do that, but that can give some really nice data to support your economic arguments. Then, of course, there's all the data that exists and is just generally being collected every day, like the administrative insurance databases, which are very common in the US and more so across Europe. The UK doesn't tend to have quite so many, but that data, all about patients, the administrative data about their healthcare, is all sitting there and available for a cost to access, to be used for research purposes. So that's really helpful for things like incidence of disease, or if you want to generate a natural history of disease project, that sort of thing. It's quite nice to use this type of data to look at service delivery and how the impact of your new product or new how your product might change a service to be more efficient. So you can either collect or use existing data to look at waiting times, patient numbers, how quickly patients move through the service. You can include patient and staff satisfaction in that as well, with one service versus another. So that's quite a nice way to get under the skin of more local services as well. And then on the right-hand side of this slide, you'll see there's lists all sorts of, you can actually go directly to patients and carers and HCPs to collect all sorts of things. So you can use validated patient-reported outcome measures where you're particularly looking at things like quality of life. They may be quite generic quality of life, or they may be quite disease-specific. You can look at patient preference, patient experience. So all sorts of nice, colourful data that adds to the package of data that you're collating for your study. And there are all sorts of other ways to collect data as well. Do social listening exercises where you're getting information directly from patients about their opinions, about treatment, about safety events, about what happened when they switched from one medication to another. And of course, many, many people now have wearable devices that are collecting healthcare data all the time. So that can be used. And more these devices are being linked up with, for example, with diabetes treatment. And that data is being, the clinical data is being sent back directly back to clinicians as well. So all of this data is available, and with all the right permissions in place and knowing that it will answer your question, they're all potential out there to be used.
So, I mean, it's just incredible, really, the wealth of different types of RWE. When we think about hierarchy, is there a hierarchy that exists for real world evidence in terms of what sits at the top versus, so I'm just sort of thinking, for example, here, social media reported data versus, for example, population data or whatever.
Yeah. It's not officially part of any guidance, but I think this is all goes back to your original planning phase. So you need to think about what you want to use this data for. If you're planning to make a regulatory submission and use some real world evidence to support that, probably social listening type data, which perhaps could be one of the downsides to it, isn't that it's not particularly clinically robust, isn't the sort of data that you want to look for. Depends what the outcome is. But, you know, so that would lean more towards the clinical data, and potentially, depending on the database that it's come from, something that's got really good provenance and you know that the quality is good.
Fantastic. So, okay, having sort of thought about the wealth of data and thinking about the outcomes, so Sam, will you walk us through the value that real world evidence brings?
So it does bring a lot of value. And I thought when we talked about this with Helen, we thought perhaps the best thing to do is to think about some quotes from some different stakeholders. There are references at the back of this deck if anybody wants to look at these. But if we think about the stakeholders involved in the kind of development of a drug, if we start with regulators, they're very interested in real-world evidence. I mean, they've been using real-world evidence for many, many years. If you think about post-authorization safety studies, there are a lot of those that have been non-interventional studies that have been run for years. So they're very used to seeing that type of data. More recently, with the advent of gene therapies, rare disease treatments, we're seeing more and more synthetic control arms. So where it's not appropriate to have a placebo-controlled trial, people are turning to the real world to try and get their control group. And that can happen for a number of different ways. But again, the regulators are taking that data into account. And a number of regulators have now, you know, issued guidance on when they will and won't accept real world evidence, how it needs to be generated. So it's becoming much more mainstream there. The reimbursement agencies have been using real world data for many years. For most of them, they use it very much to improve their understanding of health and social care within a country generally. So they quite often like to see, you know, how many patients there are, what the patient pathway would be, how much resource use goes into that pathway, all to put the cost of a treatment into perspective. In terms of healthcare professionals, I saw a nice quote recently that said that in contrast to clinical trial data, which can be considered perfect data from the imperfect, highly selected patient, real-world evidence provides imperfect data from the perfect patient. From a healthcare professional's point of view, it's the patient that they see. It's, you know, the elderly, the patients with comorbidities, the ones who are more difficult to treat. And so they like to generate that data to see data on their own patients or patients like theirs. Come back to industry in a moment, but from a patient and carer perspective, this is something that, you know, we often get involved with patient charities, patient groups who have their own real world evidence needs. And for them to see data that's from someone like them is really important, that it gives them the assurance of how a treatment might benefit them personally. And for all of those reasons is why industry are very interested in real world evidence. So in order to get your license, to get reimbursement, for your healthcare professionals to want to use your product and for a patient to want to take it, that's why for industry are investing a lot of money in generating real world evidence appropriately. And, you know, not for every product and not for every product at every stage of the life cycle. So it's very much going back to Georgie's first point about identifying what is the need for a particular product, and then, you know, very carefully designing a program that generates that data.
Fantastic. So, yeah, big question. So when should you start to think about it? So we did a webinar last year called The Power of Four, which is available for anyone listening as part of our One community. And that was really thinking. So we had someone from marketing, we had market access, we had medical affairs, and we had R&D coming together to explore this very topic about when should you think about it. So Georgie, would you like to walk us through this slide?
Yeah, of course. And I think the important thing to take away from this is that you can gather useful real-world evidence to support your product at any time in its life cycle. You don't have to wait until it's launched. So Sam's going to expand on this in a moment and talk about some real-life sort of more use cases. But I guess the key is you don't have to wait till it's launched and then scrabble to try and collect some real-world evidence. We need to get these teams planning long in advance to make sure that you're gathering the data you need in a calm and considered way as you go along. So aside from just generating early clinical experience data on real patients, which is valuable in itself, there are multiple opportunities throughout your product's life cycle or reasons post-launch to generate real-world evidence. Some of them listed on this slide. So you might want to support pricing discussions, possibly in different countries as products launch at different times. And you might want to differentiate against new competition that's moving into the market. You might want to generate real world data on new formulations as your product lifecycle moves on. Or you might want to underpin the value arguments for your product when your competitors start to go generic. So there's all sorts of reasons, very valid reasons, why real-world evidence can be really supportive to your product.
Okay. So, and I think you've already answered this question. Well, we've started to get a sense of this, but Sam, why should you bother? You know, help us understand a little bit more. Oh, okay, so we have it here.
So kind of going back to what Georgie's just said, that pre-launch, there's a lot of real-world evidence that you could generate. And I guess it's worth saying at the outset that not every drug needs everything on this slide. And one project may generate data that provides everything you need for all of these things. But I suppose if you're thinking pre-launch that you may want to collect some data to understand the standard of care, you might want to understand unmet need or disease burden in your population. Quite importantly, you may want to collect some real-world evidence that helps with your trial design for your RCTs or with patient recruitment. So you might need to understand where are these patients, who's seeing them, where do we position our trial sites. You might want to generate some data that shows patient-reported outcomes that perhaps you don't have from your clinical trials, or the measures that have been used in your clinical trials aren't the measure that your reimbursement body or your KOLs would like to see. As you get closer to launch, things become, of course, more commercial, and you may want real-world evidence to help look at the budget impact of a new product. You may have to collect some safety data in terms of PAS studies. And then kind of as the product gets then more and more, the uptake of the product continues and new competitors come into the market, you may want to then look at how it's being used in the real world, how it's being dosed in the real world, what happens when patients stop taking treatment, when they switch to other treatments, what do they switch to? And you might want to look at real world outcomes. So, you know, for oncology products, you might want to look at real world progression-free survival or overall survival, looking to kind of reduce some of the uncertainties that you probably launched with, because of course clinical trials, you know, they're there for as long as they have to be, where lots of patients take treatments a lot longer in the real world. So it continues. There are many, many things that you would use this data for.
Fabulous. So how do you do it then? Let's think, and I know we've talked about a lot of concepts and the importance of processes and so on. Georgie.
There are many different ways to solve the problem of generating real-world evidence that you need. We've got some examples on here. The process that I talked you through earlier is similar for most studies. And again, there could be some studies that are very complex and some that aren't, but the process will look fairly similar. These studies may be sponsored by pharma, they may be performed by academia, or they may be independent investigator-led studies, sometimes still sponsored by pharma, but sort of at an arm's length. In a nutshell, if the data already exists, we're talking about a secondary data study with existing data. Now, that might be a single hospital data set, a nice data set some clever forward-thinking clinician has decided to start generating and keep populating. It might be a national one, it might be a global one, who knows. So if the data exists and you know that the granularity of data that you need to answer your questions is in that data set, then by all means you can access it. You will have to pay to access it, and sometimes those costs are really quite astronomical, and you will have to wait a certain amount of time while it all progresses through and you get access to the data. And again, sometimes those timelines are really unreasonably long in some cases. So that's all part of your planning phase. If you can wait that long and the cost to access that data fits in your budget, that may be the answer you need. If you can't, or the answer, the data, the specific data that you need is not in existing data sets, and that's quite common because things are not coded down to the nth level that you need it. Specific drugs might not be coded in the data set you're looking at, or specific methodologies. So if you need to go out and find other data, you can do that. And generally that's using what we call a primary data study, where you're generating data specifically for research purposes. Now you can go in, and if you're doing a primary data study, you can look retrospectively back through or prospectively. You can do both. You can, if the data doesn't exist then and you're making this bespoke plan, then it could be a mix of chart review, where you actually dive into patients' medical records. It could be the surveys that we've mentioned earlier, the patient reported outcomes. There's all sorts of ways to generate that data. Another a slightly more long-term commitment that some pharmaceutical companies may decide to make is to support a registry. Sometimes this may be in collaboration with some charities. I guess there's two parts to setting up a registry. There's the setting it up, which is all well and good, and then there's the generating enough passion and interest amongst all the clinicians to keep putting that data in, because they're not being supported necessarily to do that. So what if this registry is going to be really useful and full of really good, helpful data in the future, then needs to be good uptake of people updating those registries. So that's another option. Another thought is on this slide, if you need a robust clinical consensus using a methodology that's an accepted scientific process, a Delphi panel might be the right solution for you, which allows your healthcare professionals or key opinion leaders to answer questions through structured rounds of questioning until consensus is obtained on the topic, the clinical topic that you're talking about. So that's another nice way, potentially slightly shorter than launching a whole chart review, but to get some really valid clinical data.
Fabulous. So, you know, a number of different options, and I'm immediately, you know, thinking about the whole investigator-initiated study scenario. You know, that in itself, I guess, in terms of timelines, can be a real challenge, because we are hands off, aren't we? Once that study is underway, really very difficult for us as industry to influence that. And if you are working to critical timelines, so I suppose there's a certain element of risk there, which kind of takes me neatly onto the last point about the challenges, Sam. So I would you like to touch on this? And I imagine that there's many challenges, but I'll let you walk us through this.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. So there are challenges that real-world evidence, if you think about it, is inherently biased, that it isn't an RCT. It hasn't been designed to negate all bias. So there will be issues there. You know, what we find from real-world evidence is that data quality can be quite questionable sometimes. Sometimes the data lacks credibility. As Georgie's talked about, the process for accessing and extracting data can be timely and can be quite costly too. And then once you've got the data, the kind of interpretation of that data can be challenging. Generating data itself, of course, data privacy and data governance is very, very important. So there are a number of things here that we kind of think about in terms of solutions, that things that really, really will help when you're thinking about putting together a real-world evidence plan or a study. The first one is feasibility, that feasibility is key. So you need to be aware that data could have been collected for other purposes. If you're looking at claims data, you need to kind of think, keep in mind, why was this data collected and what therefore is the challenge going to be? Looking very carefully at incomplete or inaccurate data, that, you know, you need to make sure that your primary endpoint is a data that's definitely collected and collected routinely. Once you've decided that, yes, your study is feasible, then having the right robust study design and rigorous analytical methods are key. So you need to design your study so you're minimising bias. The best thing is to have the right design rather than try and use your analysis to kind of unpick the biases that you've got. So making sure you've got the right design, you're using the right analytical methods, particularly existing data sets. They can be very complex. They can be subject to a lot of confounding. In terms of data privacy and governance, there's nothing you can do except to know what the regulations are, and they will be different in most countries, but you need to know when you need patient consent, when you don't, when you need ethics approval, when you don't, whether any other approvals are needed, so data governance, hospital approvals, approval from the dataset owner, they're all considerations that you need to think about. Understanding the data landscape is very important, so right back at the start, before you even do your feasibility, understanding what data already exists is really critical. So making sure that you understand what databases exist, whether there are any registries or other data sources that you could potentially use. And you need to understand what the limitations are from those data sets, how you could access it, the cost of it. So it's quite a big piece of work that you probably need to do as you're designing your study. And the final thing is working with experts who can help. So you'll have it. For a lot of particularly large pharma companies, you'll have internal experts who are experts at real-world evidence, at generating it. Dataset owners can be very, very helpful. So they're the companies that own the data. Of course, they'll have examples of projects they've done before. They'll have data on what, you know, the completeness of their data set, how to access it. And obviously working with your own experts, so healthcare professionals, a lot of them are researchers at heart, and they certainly would be able to help. And then finding the right specialist agencies. If you need an agency, then, you know, maybe you need some health economics help. So they're all things that, you know, we'd advise that you think about. When you think about the challenges, there are many solutions, we think.
Gosh, such a lot to think about. So In just under 40 minutes, we've gone quite deep, really, you know, thinking about what we mean, thinking about process, considerations, you know, value. There's just such a lot to consider. I suppose it's really important to identify, you know, who has overall responsibility. I mean, I'm guessing that there are roles, individuals are tasked with real-world evidence roles within pharma, but this is really across functional perspective. In both of your experience, who do your key contacts tend to be? Who is it that you're talking to in the context of real world evidence?
Depending on the company, it depends slightly. And I suppose depending on the stage of the drug at the life cycle will kind of depend. You know, often we get contacted by medical affairs who want to generate some data post-launch. It would more routinely be health economics, outcome research, market access teams who perhaps need to generate that data pre-launch. But even where we get contacted by HEOR or market access, medical affairs are always critical. There will always be a medical affairs person involved in the project, whether it's being led by somebody else or not.
As Sam said, these are the references that were cited on her slide. I just want to say thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. It's been really educational, certainly for me. Sam and Georgie, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
No problem. Goodbye, everyone.